The European project was formed way back in 1957, but this year could turn out to be a watershed as voters across the continent send an emphatic anti-European message. In last month's European elections, people in France, Greece and the UK voted in unprecedented numbers for Eurosceptic or even racist parties. It's now estimated that as many as 30% of the seats in the next European Parliament will be held by anti-European parties. This sentiment is a backlash, presumably, against the harsh austerity measures, high levels of unemployment and the widespread havoc this has played with people's lives across the continent. The question now is whether the EU can adequately respond to the call for change. With us from Athens is a familiar guest to Late Night Live, Yanis Varoufakis, who is Professor of Economic Theory from the University of Athens and a former advisor to Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou. Welcome to Late Night Live, Yanis.
Hello, Norman.
So what do these election results mean for the EU? I mean, surely it must have people looking seriously at its future.
Well, judging by the reaction of the great and the good, it is business as usual. But as you indicated, these results are quite catastrophic for the European project, for the idea that Europe is inevitable. Instead, what was inevitable was the Eurozone crisis, and it was followed by an inane handling that has created a 1930s-style depression in the south of Europe, deflationary forces in the north, and of course, just like the 1930s, it is the ultra-right that emerges as the sole beneficiary.
Why do you say the Eurozone crisis was inevitable?
It was a little bit like taking a fine riverboat and launching it in the Pacific Ocean, trying to cross from Australia to California. You know, as long as the weather holds up, it looks quite magnificent. The first storm,
so the design is wrong for
causes
the conditions.
It was not designed to sustain the shock waves of the great earthquake of 2008. It's as simple as that.
And so the flow on from the Eurozone crisis, which you argue was ineptly handled, and you get this extremism to the right you're talking about, I mean, reflecting not entirely our previous conversation, but often what happens in this situation and what happened in the 30s is that you've got a schism between extreme right and extreme left. And I think you've argued that, in fact, that's not what you're seeing in Europe today. There's not much countervailing extreme left factionalism.
Indeed, the only left-wing, radical left-wing party that did well was the Greek Syriza party. And it is certainly not the Eurosceptic party. If you look at its platform, it is not proposing to exit even the Eurozone. It's quite a pro-European party. The only difference between that party and other mainstream parties is that it advocates confrontation with Brussels and Frankfurt on the question of economic policies, particularly in Greece. But it is not, in no way can it be considered to be a Eurosceptic or an anti-European party. The only forces on the Eurosceptic side that did well were the extreme right-wing ones in France with Ms. Le Pen and her Front National, KIP, in Hungary with neo-Nazis, and so on and so forth.
And why then, I mean, obviously in Greece you have got this schism between extreme right and extreme left with the Golden Door, but you're saying that in other countries it's more to the right. Well, why to the right? Why haven't you got this countervailing balance, if you like, even though it is extremism which most people would find unpleasant?
Well, this is an excellent question. Look, we all know that in 1991 the Marxist left collapsed under the moral weight of the Soviet Empire. Now, very soon after, by the mid-1990s, the social democratic left was co-opted in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Greece, in Spain. It was co-opted by the financiers into a kind of what I call a Faustian bargain. And the bargain was between the center-left that would turn a blind eye to the bankers' shenanigans, and that also included the particular construction of the Eurozone, and in return, they would get some crumbs of the financiers' table to fund European welfare states.
So effectively borrowing to pay for welfare?
Not borrowing, no. They were getting taxes from the tsunami of capital gains and profits that the financiers were making. So instead of taxing industry in order to fund hospitals, for instance, they would tax bankers. But at the same time, they would turn a blind eye to the production of toxic money by the financial centers in the city of London, in Frankfurt, in Paris, and so on. So when in 2008, this house of financial cards, it tumbled and it bloated.
There was no ticket to clip anymore.
Exactly. So what the centre-left at that point had left had no analytical capacity left, or indeed the moral authority to put the financiers back in their place. So that left the ultra-xenophobic right as the only political force capable of expressing the anger felt by the crisis victims.
But there is a some confluence of ideas, because there is a push within the EU for people who are relatively committed to it for a smaller EU government, and perhaps even a smaller EU.
That debate has been festering now since 1993. But what I think you are referring to, and this is quite a dominant move these days, is indeed for the Eurozone to turn itself into a kind of federation. But what kind of federation? Not the kind of federation that we have in Australia, not the kind of federation that we have in the dollar zone on the other side of the Pacific or the Atlantic, but a very special kind of federation. If you look at these proposals that you're referring to, they're talking about effectively turning the Eurozone into an austerity union and creating a Euro government, the purpose of which will be to impose with a degree of legitimacy that is currently lacking the inane policies that have created this crisis.
So driven by Germany is what you're getting at.
Yes, but no, it's not just that it is by Germany. It's also by a number of interests within France, which are at odds with the multitudes in France. So you have a kind of coalition across the Franco-German axis, the purpose of which is to create a Euro government that is going to promote what most Europeans see as a kind of iron cage of a Eurozone. As I said, an austerity union as opposed to a European union that will be grossly undemocratic.
But isn't that what they've got already, an austerity union? I mean, there's not been much fiscal stimulus, which I think you argue for, as opposed to quantitative easing, which is basically printing money.
Indeed, what we have is exactly that. But you know what? What we have now, quite evidently, even in the eyes of the dominant forces in Paris and in Frankfurt and in Brussels and in Berlin, what it does lack is it lacks democratic legitimacy. So moving in the direction of a federation that creates a minimal federal government, the purpose of which is to clamp down and to make austerity permanent, is the way things are moving. And this is precisely why the disenfranchised and those who don't feel privileged by the present set of circumstances are rebelling, and they are rebelling with such venom that they are turning, unfortunately and quite tragically, xenophobic.
How effective is the European Parliament? I remember when Britain went into the EU, I think it was called the EC in those days, but it was thought to be a fairly ineffective rubber stamp organisation, which really had very little effect. How would you assess its efficacy now as a political body and a legislature versus what it might become if your theory is correct?
Well, for purposes of full discretion, let me relate to you that in this European Parliament election, I was offered the safe seat in the European Parliament, which I turned down. And I turned it down for a very simple reason. About a year and a half ago, I was invited to address the European Parliament, which I did. And after that talk, I was completely and totally dumbfounded to have a number of members of the European Parliament from different political parties, from the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, coming up to me and saying, you know, what you're saying is very interesting, but why are you bothering with us? Do you think we can do anything? So
they sit there in Strasbourg or Brussels and feel ineffective.
Indeed. I mean, they're a rubber stamp for policies that they mostly disagree with, regardless of which political party they belong to. What is interesting, however, now, is that there is a massive, titanic struggle between the European Parliament and the heads of government for around the question of who is going to be the next president of the European Commission.
You see, because Britain doesn't want Luxembourg.
Yes, but Britain is a peripheral, marginal voice in this tussle. It simply complicates the way that this war is progressing. The war is between Mrs. Merkel and heads of government, particularly of the surplus countries, of the rich countries, on the one hand, and the European Parliament on the other. You see, before the election, European peoples were told that the heads of the major political groupings running for the European Parliament, Mr. Juncker from the Christian Democrats, Mr. Schulz from the Social Democrats, Alexis Tsipras from the European Left, and so on, they would be contesting for the position of the President of the European Commission. And there was even a debate, just like you have presidential debates, between those candidates. And then after the European Parliament election, Mrs. Merkel said, well, I don't feel constrained by these names. I can appoint Mrs. Lagarde, the head of the IMF, to be head of the European Commission. So there is this very interesting tussle now between these two centers of power in Europe. And the European Parliament is going to be the battleground on which this is going to play out. But I wouldn't hold my breath about the chances of the European Parliament progressing onto significance from the current insignificance in which it finds itself.
Explain something to me, Yanis Varoufakis. Most of the Eurozone's 18 nations are on target for deficit reduction, but my understanding is that the Eurozone's debt has continued to mount. How does that work?
Well, it's very simple, Norman, isn't it? Austerity never works, especially when it is universalized. Look, in 2008, the financial crisis caused a real economic crisis. Private sector expenditure started declining. That meant that government deficits started going up, as they do during a recession. And what did the leaders of Europe decide to do? To cut down on government spending and increase taxes throughout Europe. Now, what that does is that it reduces public expenditure. So when public expenditure and private expenditure decline simultaneously, what is the sum of these two? It's the national income, the income of the Eurozone as a whole. So that declines. You end up with a recession. Debts are not depleted. Debts increase when incomes are reduced. So the debt to GDP ratio goes up. This is, you know, we've known this since the 1930s. So it's quite amazing, isn't it? Not that the 1930s experience has been repeated with such alacrity and with such commitment on the part of Europe.
Now, Cameron has promised a referendum on the EU. What would happen if Britain left?
Not much, I don't think. And let me put it simply. The way that we have created this Eurozone disaster in Europe, there are two possible routes ahead. One is that we will fix the Eurozone and the Eurozone will survive. If we do that, it will be very, very difficult for countries like Britain and Denmark to remain in the European Union, but not in the Eurozone. On the other hand, the second route will see to
because it'll be hard, Eurozone. Because it will be harder to stay out of the zone because it will be more sensibly planned. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it will be more sensibly planned, and most of the energies of the European Union would be channeled towards running the Eurozone.
And it's not something politically they could get through their own electorate.
Indeed. And on the other hand, if the Eurozone crumbles, shrivels and dies, then the whole of the European Union is going to follow suit. It's going to become something like, you know, the former Soviet Union that tried to remain relevant by becoming the Commonwealth of Independent States, but it will simply wither. So one way or the other, I see that very hard for Britain to stay within the European Union the way it is. What is crucial for Britain is that it remains hooked into the financial world of the Eurozone so that the City of London remains the main funding ground for Europe. But I suspect that it will not be too hard for Britain to find a way of establishing a special relation with the European Union to stay outside. Now, why does Britain need to do that? It doesn't need to get out at the moment. But I believe that UKIP and Nigel Farage, as well as the Eurosceptics within the Tories, have tapped into a rich vein of discontent that has its origins not with Brussels so much, but in Mrs. Thatcher's neoliberalism. And what we're finding today is this situation where UKIP voters are people who feel that their own elites in Britain have left them behind to rot in the shadows of neoliberalism a long, long time ago, and now they're turning their, you know, their arrows at Brussels, making Mr. Cameron think very seriously of the political expediency involved in having a referendum.
Because he could let them cop the blame. And just finally, Yanis, how are things in countries like Greece and Italy at the moment?
Particularly this is Greece. The long, long, long winter of our discontent. It may be very hot and sticky these days in Greece because of the summer, but if you look at the south of Italy, Greece, Portugal, Spain, indeed Ireland, and you look beyond the propaganda about success stories and the end of Troika-led bailout programs and so on, what you will find is a great depression that has absolutely nothing to envy of the 1930s Great Depression.
So, can you see a way through? I mean,
yes.
I mean, you got to primary surplus last year in Greece, didn't you?
Yes, but that is a joke. If you look at the primary surplus, it's a huge deficit. This is, the triumph of creative accounting, the purpose of which is to allow Mrs. Merkel and the European Commission to declare victory in Greece, because if they declare victory in Greece, they can declare victory over the Eurozone crisis. What really matters at the moment in Greece is the following numbers, the following facts. Firstly, employment is continuing to fall. Secondly, credit to even profitable firms is continuing to fall. And thirdly, investment remains negative. There can be no recovery under those circumstances. And these are the circumstances for the whole of the periphery, including Ireland.
And you're suggesting a pan-European investment-led recovery?
Look, in 1932, 1933, the Great Depression would not have been lifted had it not been for the New Deal by FDR. We need something equivalent. We need a European New Deal in Europe as a whole. It is pathetic to be talking about the Greek crisis or the Portuguese crisis. Imagine if in 1929 or 1930, in the United States, there was a lot of talk about the crisis of South Dakota. It would be ludicrous. Or imagine if, again in the 1930s, in Australia, you talked about the great crisis of Tasmania. I mean, of course, Tasmania was suffering, but it was suffering only because it was caught in a much bigger crisis than itself. Same in Europe. Either we're going to deal with it at a pan-European level with a European New Deal, or we're going to remain in the clasps of our postmodern Great Depression.
And an FDR is going to have to appear from somewhere.
Yes, but we can't see one in the offing, I'm afraid.
And there isn't necessarily a structure for that FDR person to express themselves.
Indeed, there isn't. Mr. Renzi in Italy is making noises to the effect that he's positioning himself to play such a role. I very much doubt that he has the courage or the intellect to do it, but I hope that I'm spectacularly wrong.
He's a good-looking boy, so at least he's telegenic. Yanis, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, Norm.
Yanis Varoufakis, who was speaking to us via Skype from Athens. He's director of the Political Economy Division at the University of Athens, and he's also a visiting professor at the University of Texas. I'm Norman Swan, and you're listening to LNL here on RN.